Hi, this is Robin Daly with another Yes to Life show, looking at new developments and understandings in the world of cancer and cancer treatment, particularly focusing on the developing science of integrative medicine, an approach that combines methods from both conventional and complementary medicine. In today's show, I'm going to be finding out about an old and controversial piece of legislation that affects the practice of cancer treatment in many ways, but which relatively few have any awareness of, the 1939 Cancer Act. To do this, I'm talking to one of the UK's leading experts in health legislation, Dr. Robert Verkirk, founder and scientific director of the Alliance for Natural Health, or the ANH. I visited him at the ANH offices in Dorking. Welcome back to the Yes to Life show, Rob.
Fantastic to be with you once again, Robin.
It's always a pleasure to have you on. Today we've got a very specific subject. I'm going to talk about the 1939 Cancer Act, a strange piece of legislation. Not everybody knows it's even there. Maybe more do than ever did before. But, you know, we don't have a Diabetes Act or a Heart Disease Act. Why do we have a Cancer Act? And what were the circumstances behind it appearing?
Well, the interesting thing about an act that dates just to the start of the Second World War is having a look at what was happening in cancer treatment at that time. The use of radiation in cancer therapies was just starting to gather some steam. And prior to that, there were a very wide array of different approaches that were being used, including the use of botanicals. And it's ironic that we should go now into the 21st century and see, if you look, for example, at the science on turmeric and curcuminoids within turmeric, or resveratrol that comes from grape skins and also Japanese knotweed, these are some of the most interesting botanicals in their use for cancer therapy. So if you go back to the pre-Second World War period, there were a very wide range of different approaches being used. And the understanding was that radiation would be the absolute solution to cancer. And essentially what they needed was an act to prohibit people other than those that were elected, authorized healthcare professionals from talking about different forms of cancer treatment as well as delivering it. And in addition to that, they needed a system whereby the government through the Ministry of Health could actually give money to the National Radium Trust so that they could actually continue their work. And of course, let's understand, when we talk about radiation treatments or chemotherapy, chemical treatments, these are very big umbrella terms that define a very wide use of different sources of radiation, from gamma rays to ionizing radiation, for example. And the same goes for chemotherapy. And of course, at the moment, we have essentially three main pillars to cancer treatment, which involve radiotherapy, chemotherapy, and surgery. And to this day, the Cancer Act that basically lives on, the primary effective article or section is Section 4 of it, which is limited to the advertising of treatments for cancer, and it restricts that advertising specifically to healthcare professionals, particularly medical doctors, nurses, and pharmacists. And what's very interesting about it is it says these are the only people who can advertise, but the definition or the scope of the definition of advertising is so broad that it actually refers to any kind of communication, even oral communications about it. So, and then the other aspect about it, if you breach the Cancer Act, so if you are, for example, a complementary or alternative medicine practitioner and you talk about treatments about cancer, it is a criminal offense to break the Cancer Act. And of course, it can apply very, very broadly, as we have all found ourselves party to this, to discussions with the public about so-called alternative or non-standard treatments of cancer. So to this day, it lives on. One of the fascinating things about it as well is that there have been very few attempts to for people to defend themselves under the Act. So if you chase through the case reports in the legal text, you'll find only a very, very small number, in fact only two, and one of them dates back to the use of cascara for cancer treatments back in 1947. So it really hangs there like this big axe to be wielded, and the primary control in this day and age is at the local authority level and at the trading standards level. So at the moment, what tends to happen is individuals are slapped very, very hard across the wrist if they do breach it. And of course, the terms are pretty unambiguous. So, for a doctor who may want to talk about so-called alternative treatments, they also run the gauntlet themselves, in the sense that they will be challenged by the General Medical Council for talking about a non-standard treatment. So it's pretty a closed system, as it were, that's very, very difficult to work around.
Quite a little hot potato. So it's a very short piece of legislation in itself, but partly due to its age and the way it gets interpreted under circumstances that didn't even exist back in 1939, there's huge misunderstandings as to its actual effect, I think, amongst practitioners and even amongst people like trading standards, in my experience. They apply it where it's really not relevant. So in plain English, what does it actually say and how does it actually get applied?
Well, in plain English, it restricts the communication of treatments, because although under the terms of the legislation it's referred to as advertising, we have to think of that as communication.
Right.
Because it's as soon as you start communicating about a treatment, you are potentially selling it. And it's interesting that the treatments on offer within the NHS are paid for by the taxpayer, so you could argue that they are, if you like, pre-sold. We right. buy their potential through our tax payments. So what it really covers is the form of cancer treatments that are available in the private realm. And of course, nearly all of alternative medicine, or CAM, is private, other than that which finds its way into, say, palliative care in NHS trusts, for example. So it is the communication of treatments linked to cancer, and essentially they are limited to just those people who are health professionals, doctors, nurses, and pharmacists, and they themselves are controlled by their own confined areas that are linked to NICE. And NICE has very, very clear guidelines on and pathways for exactly what treatments are to be prescribed for individual types of cancer.
Right, so it's all very restrictive. So it's been there a very long time, 1939, what is that, nearly 80 years it's been around, and I think in that time it's only been sort of revisited once and changed a bit. What happened?
Well, most of the active text was lost, so there were a very large number of sections, and now
much
the
longer.
So the section now that is left to us is the section 4, which is linked to the so-called prohibition of certain advertisements, and it essentially says that if you're not one of the authorized health professionals, you cannot communicate about cancer treatment. Of course, from a practical point of view, what this means is that someone who is supporting someone who has cancer, what you have to be extremely clear about is that you are not treating them. And, you know, again, what's very interesting is understanding something about how cancer functions within an individual. Many of us are beginning to understand from the science and the medicine over the last few hundred years that we all have cancer pretty much all of the time, and it is when the cancer starts to run rampant, where it's no longer the control systems for it are lost. And of course, what most people in the non-conventional area of cancer are working on is actually looking at supporting the body so that the self-correcting mechanisms that we refer to as homeostasis start to work again. And so any practitioner that is working on non-standard treatments needs to be very, very clear in any advertisements or communications that they have that they're not treating the cancer, that they're actually just supporting an individual who happens to have cancer.
Mm. Right. Important distinction. So bringing us right up to date then, we're in this age of websites and social media, etc. Very different scenario to when the Act was written. You know, what does it actually mean then about if you take somebody's, you're a practitioner, you've got a website, now you mentioned obviously they've got to, there are ways they've got to talk about it. Any other specifics?
Most people who are working with cancer patients in this field are aware of it. As I said, it's remarkable just how few prosecutions there have been in the courts under it, given that it's been around for the greater part of a century. And
why do you think that is, by the way?
I think because, you know, one of the interesting things, the UK is the primary part of the world where we think about the C word. We have become, because of the Cancer Act, so fearful, and practitioners in this fear have become so fearful of this huge weight that sits above their heads that makes them a criminal if they're going to be discussing any form of treatment, that they, many of them just simply don't use the cancer word at all. Mm. And that is one very obvious safeguard. Once you understand the intent, the meaning, and the capacity for a trading standard officer to go after you, and there have been many cases in which they have, right. And of course they don't end up in court because they're dealt with out of court, which is why we don't see them in the law reports. People have understood that you have to then be very, very careful of how you use language. And I think the great development is that as we understand more about the nature of cancer as a disease, which can manifest in so many different ways, every human being benefits from having a more balanced system. And if you are administering a range of treatments and modalities that help support the body, everyone will be in a better position. So yes, most people choose in their advertisements now, because of the Cancer Act in the UK, not to use the word cancer at all. In the strict meaning of the Cancer Act itself, you can of course use the term cancer, but you have to use it very, very clearly, saying that you're the subset of the population that are included as your clients may include people who happen to be cancer patients. The other sort of generality that you need to be very, very careful of is to make sure that there isn't an indirect implication that you are treating people. And of course, that is usually covered off very clearly by making sure that the patient is being overseen by an oncologist. And that's why I think so many of us are very interested in finding the small number, but nevertheless growing number, of oncologists that are open to concomitant treatments that involve, if you like, natural processes alongside any conventional or more targeted conventional treatments that can be used.
Mm. So what other ways could a trading standards officer kind of intuit that you were in some way conclude that you're treating them, other than not having an oncologist? Say that's one. Well, are there other ways?
Let me give our listeners an example of a conference that you and I were both involved with some years ago, and
right.
I had to fend them off at the beaches, as it were. Essentially, it is extremely important for cancer patients to receive education. And the problem is they will not get this broader education from the mainstream, because the mainstream doesn't give it a priority at the moment. The education of oncologists does not include very much about the other things that can be done that are non-standard therapies. They may have a very basic understanding of some of the dietary and lifestyle modifications that can be made, but generally would see that more for prevention rather than something that can be used actively with a patient. However, there are increasing numbers of oncologists that work alongside so-called CAM practitioners, and they generally will create a very neat delineation between what they're doing and what the CAM practitioner is doing. So as a patient, if you want to find out the diversity of developments that are going on in terms of these supporting modalities, you might want to go to a conference. And as I said, you and I found ourselves in that situation some years ago. And a civic hall was originally hired for the purpose. And it was the council that was challenged, saying this is going to be a breach of the Cancer Act if this educational event that was particularly orientated towards cancer patients should go ahead. And the bottom line is that they perceived that the education by people that were involved in practice of medicine and of alternative medicine was seen as an advertisement under the terms of the Cancer Act, Section 4. And so essentially, it would be a matter of debate. Obviously, one mechanism that you could use for that is you could say, look, we challenge your view and we'd like to go to court on it. Mm. In this particular case, there were a lot of people that had already bought tickets for the event. There was going to be some lovely organic food. What we chose to do is to convert the event from a public function to a private function. And when it is a private function, believe it or not, in this world that where we feel we're increasingly losing our fundamental human rights and freedoms, there is still an ability to have a behind closed door meeting. And of course, once that had happened, we had found a workaround. The BBC turned up and said, "Yep, we'd love to see what's going on in this conference." And I had to go down and remind them this was a private function, and they were not invited. And end of the story. And that is perfectly legitimate. But unfortunately, that is the kind of workaround that we have to live with when people are wanting to have often life-saving information provided to them, and to be around an environment where they're sharing extraordinary experiences that they're having with their own often multi-modality treatments that are often integrated treatments with others. And it's remarkable that sometimes the Cancer Act can be brought into effect to stop these things going ahead. There are always workarounds, but it's not easy, and one has to be incredibly careful about the language you use in promoting the event, and understanding exactly how you might need to develop a workaround around it and effectively create a private meeting.
Yeah, okay. So one of the regular claims that's rolled out for the Act as to, you know, why we have this thing is that it's, you know, it's protection for our vulnerable patients from all those terrible, unscrupulous quacks out there. Isn't it the case that all the regulation that's in place that applies to all medicines actually already does this job completely, and so that's not really a function of it at all?
Yes, I mean, it's meant to. We live in an environment where medicines per se are primarily regulated. There is actually a capacity for unregistered medicines So these are medicines that meet the good manufacturing practice for medicines, but have not been through a licensing system where both safety and efficacy is being confirmed. But there is a specific exemption provision under European Medicines Law, Section 5.1, Directive 2001/83/EC, for anyone who's interested, that allows, again, authorized healthcare professionals to use unregistered medicines for following one-to-one consultation. So, interestingly, that is the provision legally under European law that the UK herbalist exemption exists under the Human Medicinal Products Regulations of 2012. Yes, and of course, what that means is that herbalists, as a non-medicinally qualified or medically qualified healthcare professional, are using that exemption. So that is a provision. It's used actually very widely in countries like Germany, where if you look at the magistral prescriptions that are made by pharmacies that are operating with good manufacturing practice, they will make specific prescriptions that may include botanical prescriptions. They may also include off-license drugs. So there's many ways in which it can be used. The UK interprets that through the MHRA's special licensing system. So there is an opportunity for medical doctors to use unregistered medicines. The difficulty we have under the National Health Service is the very strict guidelines that are implemented through NICE. And as many, even those within the NHS, will say, one of the problems is that these act much more like tram lines than they do like guidelines. And you have to stick within it. And in many respects, the more junior you are within the profession, the greater the risk is for stepping outside the guidelines. And so you get essentially the most innovative consultants and oncologists, often the older ones, that first of all understand some of the limitations of the tools within their particular toolbox, and they also are more respected and less likely to face challenge.
Less to lose as well.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yes, I mean, there is a bit of scope, and it is unfortunately the NHS structure that prevents the legislation from being used as plastically as it might otherwise.
Right. So, well, this is much of what's been brought to Parliament and everything recently, isn't it, to try and give practice and to give the medical profession some more room to be, creative
innovative,
doctors.
Innovative.
It's absolutely stood on by these guidelines, as you say, which are railroad everybody into.
And there is also a kind of duality. If you look at the Medical Innovations Bill, for example, there is a large part of the supporters for that see it only as an opportunity to use medicines that are licensed for other purposes being used, for example, in cancer therapies, and they don't at all want to see any kind of an open door for anything else, particularly not if it's natural. And yet, you know, there is some extraordinary research going on in the field of natural products, specifically for cancer therapies, and that's partially because natural products within their natural state, when you haven't necessarily pulled out an isolated molecule and then created it synthetically, but within the natural state, these natural molecules and compounds often have a multi-target function. And it is this multi-target function, which you can't get from conventional drugs, that you can get from natural products, that seem to be often very important in terms of realigning the dysfunction in metabolism that is associated with cancer.
So a large missed trick. Okay, so talk a little bit about the consequences of legislating for something like this. I mean, what we have is you have a kind of divorce from science or the facts in some way. So it doesn't really matter whether something actually does or doesn't help people. It's the fact is you're not allowed to say whether it does or doesn't. So it's because of this cut off in the language, it doesn't matter whether you've got good evidence for what you're saying. You still can't say it if you're not the right person.
The bottom line is that if you are the right person, you are a medically qualified health professional, you can talk about chemotherapy. And the very fact that you know, we can all go to a nice Australian study comparing Australian and US evidence, looking at the net efficacy of chemotherapy being around the 5% in terms of 5-year survival. So yes, it has nothing to do with effectiveness or even safety.
No.
It has to do with the limitation of discussions around cancer. Cancer has been selected out in a way that no other disease has been, and that's
absolutely,
that's to a degree on one hand because it is one of the most emotive diseases out there, and the so-called cancer cure has not been found, and there have been, you know, billions and billions expended on it, and it is one of the biggest industries in healthcare. So if you look at oncologics, the category of drugs used for cancer treatment is actually the single largest category of drugs out there.
It doesn't surprise me.
There is a vast amount of money to be made in that area. So it is control for the sake of control. And if you're not part of the system says you can't talk about it.
So how much do you think this one single factor, this one very short piece of legislation, how much effect do you think it's had on the progress of cancer treatment?
You know, I think it is not directly related to cancer research. I think the legislation itself, you know, the legislation stops people talking about it. It doesn't stop the notion of looking for silver bullets for cancer. So what I would say is more responsible is the way in which people see the wins coming. You know, if you're going to fund research and development in cancer, you are basically putting money, you're investing money into research with the notion that you're going to get a big payback. And that big payback, we all know, doesn't necessarily mean you're going to cure cancer. In fact, if you cured cancer, it wouldn't be much good because you wouldn't have an ongoing source of revenue. It would just be a one-shot wonder. The bottom line is that it is down to the fact that you need to have a patented drug that has usually a single target or a very limited range of targets, and that has been the rabbit warren that people have been going down really since the rapid development of organic chemistry in the post Second World War era. And that has generated very, very little. We've then seen, you know, a profound interest in the genomics of cancer and looking at targeted drugs linked to individual genomic types, and that also has failed. You know, the Cancer Act, I think, is to an extent what it has had a much bigger impact is on communication around cancer prevention, because what it has stopped is the people who essentially within the CAM field, most of the answers are available. If you look at any of the big systematic reviews or meta-analyses on cancer, we know that actually diet and lifestyle are the single most potent medicines that we have out there. They may not be curative medicines in all cases, but they're certainly very, very powerful medicines for prevention. And because of the Cancer Act, the people who could have been going out there and openly talking about cancer and being able to prevent cancer, those people have not done it because they are, you know, living in fear of being regarded as a criminal and potentially facing the consequences of being a criminal. So it's had a big, big impact on that. And cancer prevention, you know, is probably the most sensible long-term approach to actually dealing with cancer, rather than restricting ourselves to the end of the disease cycle when it's very, very difficult to undo the damage that may have been incurred over decades. So I think that, prevention, we've suffered hugely. In terms of curative, I think we've been chasing silver bullets, looking at the wrong targets and the wrong places for the wrong reasons. I think it's a separate issue,
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's no connection between conventional cancer treatment and trying to avoid cancer. They're nothing to do with each other. But so that the lifestyle runs right through the whole thing, doesn't it?
Exactly. And it often means that you need to turn the wick up on some of the things. When you already have a significant dysfunction within the metabolism of an individual, it might be that you do need to use higher amounts of particular dietary components or botanicals or any other form of treatment, just as we do with chemotherapy or radiation. You know, our bodies are designed to take a certain amount of radiation. They are certainly able to take a certain level of toxin exposure from our environment. And many of the foods that we eat have toxic functions, and we have very well inbuilt systems. However, it's interesting that we dose up on radiation and we dose up on particular toxins in order to actually resolve the problem, because we want to remove those particular tumors. In the case of a natural approach, what we're really looking at is looking at the immune system, largely getting on top of it and reestablishing balance. And often that means doing something that's a little bit different from what you might do over a lifetime to prevent the disease manifesting in the first place.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, well, you were talking a bit earlier about the fact that, one of the safest ways for any practitioner to avoid any trouble is they don't even use the word cancer. But increasingly, certainly over the time that Yes to Life's been around, more and more are prepared to talk about what they're doing. I mean, it's certainly 10 years ago, very few stuck their head above the parapet. There seems to be more confidence to actually speak about it and to know a way of speaking about it that actually doesn't break the law, but it does alert people to knowing what they offer. Maybe you could, I imagine we're going to have quite a few practitioners listening to this, maybe you could give a few guidelines as to where you can draw the line between things you can talk about and things you can't.
Well, yes, absolutely. Starting point might be in terms of education. We've said how important education in this field is. So education where you are educating another health professional or a health coach, you can speak very, very openly, because that individual is not a cancer patient. You're not advertising a cancer treatment to them. And the same general rules apply, you know, in terms of integrity and having a reasonable evidence base, a plausible evidence base. Obviously, it's got to be based on science, but there is a huge gamut of science out there that is very supportive of multimodality approaches in cancer, like any other multifactorial disease. So health professional, if you like, business to business, health professional to health professional, is a very straightforward place to start. So if you're then going from that health professional to the potential cancer patient, or the cancer patient where you absolutely are targeting a cancer patient, at that point you need to be very, very clear about what you're doing. And the critical thing is that you never use the term treatment or prevention in relation to any disease unless you are a medically qualified practitioner.
It also applies to prevention then.
So if you are using a product, if you're using a product, you are in breach of the Medicines Act, or the which exists both in UK law as well as in European law. Mm. So you cannot refer to any single product that either treats or prevents a disease. Okay,
so, okay, so that's across the board.
That's across the board. Right. And that creates a major distinction between someone who is medically qualified and someone who isn't. And that, in addition to the Cancer Act, if you like, puts another barrier in the way for someone who wants to use, for example, diet and lifestyle as a mechanism for cancer prevention. Mm. And that relates only to products, because under the definition of a medicine, under the medicine's law.
So food doesn't apply.
Well, it does if it is a product. So we've had a situation where supermarkets have been challenged and forced to change the labeling when they discovered, for example, that mangoes contained anti-cancer compounds. Mm. And you found that you know, a major supermarket chain, when it wanted to promote the sale of its mangoes, it declared the fact that these mangoes were very good to reduce the risk of cancer, heart disease, and a range of other diseases. Mm. They were very quickly pulled up by trading standards, and the supermarket responded and saying, well, these are just mangoes. And trading standards came back, no, they are the mangoes that are associated with your supermarket, so they are a product, a definitive food product. Oh. So the difference is that if you as a practitioner want to talk about generic mangoes,
okay,
you're welcome
selling
to.
Mangoes.
No.
Right,
but
the minute
you're
sell
talking
them
about
your own mangoes,
as soon as they become a product, a saleable product or commodity, okay, then you have a problem.
Okay.
So the issue is to be very good at talking in generic terms. And secondly, it's very important to create a Chinese wall between any information you've given to a potential or actual cancer patient that is generic and that which is a product. And essentially the way in which many practitioners do it is to, and this is certainly what we advise through the Alliance for Natural Health, is that you send product specific recommendations, be these foods, food supplements, herbal products, or anything else, separately from any conversation or information that you've been supplying generically. So sometimes a patient may be interested in the scientific evidence. So to give an example, for example, around turmeric, you may provide a research paper that may even look at a specific form of turmeric together with, say, bioperin or turmeric essential oils, the key additional ingredients that are required to make the product bioavailable. When you then showing how that might work to reduce the risk of cancer, you want to supply, probably by email, on a separate email, your overall list of recommendations. And you've effectively then created a Chinese wall, so you are not directly advertising under the Cancer Act 1939 or breaching medicines law by considering that these products are, in fact, unregistered medicines.
Yeah, it's tricky stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. And you mentioned earlier about this is, again, in my experience, is something that's come into the language in the last 10 years, is the realization that actually most CAM therapies are, in fact, supporting your own immune system or making you well, basically. They're supporting good health. They're not necessarily anti-cancer in themselves. And that gives you a whole gamut of language to talk about what you're offering in a way which is not treating cancer, it's actually making you healthy enough so as you can deal with cancer.
Yes, I mean, within the world of healthcare, there are many different views on how an individual gets better. And one of the sad things about the way in which the effects of pharmaceutical medicine are viewed, for example, if you cut yourself and you then apply an antiseptic lotion to that cut, and you don't get an infection, the assumption often made is that that pharmaceutical medicine has been effective. Mm. And what is ignored is the huge natural immune system that has gone on to protect. And in many respects, that antiseptic is just one of several things that has happened. Mm. And unfortunately, our immune system, which is the most sophisticated system that we know to manage our own bodies, is often, you know, regarded as some kind of second-class citizen that we take for granted.
Yeah.
And it's undertaking a phenomenal role in maintaining our health nearly all of the time.
Mm.
And at other times in our life, it struggles and it needs some support. Yeah. And so if you look at the world of, say, naturopathy, for well over a century, there's been a very strong understanding that self-healing is probably the single most important influence. And yet, we don't really, in the mainstream context, think very much about the importance of self-healing, despite the fact that it's, you know, even if you break your leg and you go to acute care in a hospital, self-healing, the process that actually repairs the bone, is actually the most important part of the equation.
Yeah, facilitating
that. Exactly. The rest of it is just a little bit of support, you know, with some bracing, for example, that the doctor's been able to provide. They're doing infection control, but the body, through its self-healing mechanism, and the same really applies to cancer as well.
Mm. Okay. And just say here, one of our hapless practitioners steps over the line, or somebody out there has been combing through their website looking for problems, they're given a call by the trading standards. What's the best course of action at that point? Are there places they can go for advice? How should they deal with the situation?
Normally what would happen is that they get such a scare from receiving a letter that suggests that they may have effectively made themselves a criminal for a particular discussion. They get one letter, and that they then change their tune. Over the years, obviously, we've had a lot of people coming to us saying, you know, what do we need to do? And often it's just a slight readjustment of what they're saying. So they don't need to stop what they're doing necessarily. One of the advantages, while it's, you know, an act that can be applied with the full force of the law, including fining people and putting people into jail, that doesn't tend to happen.
No.
And, you know, if we look at our colleagues in the United States, where I will be as of Wednesday again, they often look at the Cancer Act and EU laws and they say, you know, guys, I don't know how you ever let it get so bad over in Europe. The difference is that in the US there are people who have sold various alternative cancer treatments who have done significant jail time. And that, you know, includes Jason Vale, who is out selling apricot kernels.
Mm.
He responded very well himself, he believes, to taking apricot kernels containing vitamin B17, amygdalin, and leotrol. And he then went out on the road telling people his story and selling a lot of apricot kernels on the back of it. And he did jail time for that.
Yeah. So if he hadn't been selling the apricot kernels, he'd been okay.
Precisely.
Does the same thing apply in America?
It does for under the FTC rules and the FDA rules. It's very, very similar, yes. Generally speaking, it's a little bit more liberal in terms of what is allowed under structure function claims. So, and increasingly, as long as you've got two trials to support what you're saying, it will generally be allowed. The problem is when you blatantly breach the laws, the resulting consequences on the person that has broken the law are very much more severe.
Right, draconian.
Yeah.
Am I right in thinking that Canada has, for a much longer period, had a situation where basically if you can produce some reasonable evidence for what you're saying, that you're allowed to do it?
Yes and no. The natural health product regulations that came in a few years ago have created a much more restricted environment.
Oh,
and in that process, probably about one-third of all the products that were on the Canadian market have disappeared.
Wow.
The ones who've survived are the ones that are supported by better evidence and have NHP registrations. Mm. So Canada has faced a very, essentially what happened in Canada is they allowed a, if you like, a third category. So in Europe, for products in this area, we think of either foods or medicine. So it's a two category system. In Canada, what they decided to do is have a third category to say, look, there are foods, there are medicines, but then in addition, we'll have this category called natural health products. And okay. And so they all have gone through a registration scheme. Having seen a few products and worked with a few products that have gone through that scheme, it is a lot more open-minded through Health Canada than, for example, the system that is used by the European Food Safety Authority in Europe to provide positive opinions that allow licensing to go through in Europe.
Seems a bit more intelligent in some ways than trying to leverage everything into one of two categories, sort of black and white, you know.
Exactly.
To actually have something which is a bit more
fitting. I mean, it would be a very risky system with the kind of mindset that we see in the UK through the MHRA. And obviously, as we move in the UK through to Brexit, losing the ability to defend products through case law precedents in the European Court, losing access to the European Court of Human Rights, potentially leaves us in a sort of more uncertain world, and the MHRA certainly are not well disposed towards natural treatments and natural therapies. So there's going to have to be a lot of pressure to get the more permissive environment that could be available to us in the UK. It's going to require a lot of hard work, and something we're deeply involved in working on at the moment.
Yeah, it's a big unknown, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so what if you're a manufacturer? We've been talking about practitioners generally, okay? You're a manufacturer of supplements. How does the Cancer Act affect you and what you can do and what you can't do?
Well, the bottom line is if you don't mention the C word, you are going to be fine from the point of view of the Cancer Act itself. Where you have a problem is more under medicines law and invoking the second limb of the definition of medicine that is effectively prescribed so broadly that it makes anything a medicine. It basically says if you correct, modify, restore physiological functions in the body and exert a pharmacological, immunological or metabolic action, you're a medicine.
That's everything you take in.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
So that's a glass of water or a cup of tea.
Right.
What it then has is a preamble to the legislation that says if you are clearly a food or a food supplement, you're exempt from medicines law. And then it says in Article 2, Section 2, it says in cases of doubt, medicines law shall apply over any other law. Mm. So effectively it's this triangular system that gives the regulator a loaded gun. It says by definition, and let's remember this law was developed because of the thalidomide case in 1965.
Yeah.
And so they scoped it very, very broadly. And then they basically allow you a way out. And in practical terms, what it is saying is if you are a concentrated source of nutrient that's normally consumed as part of the diet, no one will argue that you are not clearly a food supplement. As soon as you're talking about a substance that might be, for example, made endogenously, so let's look at something like glutathione, for example. You consume very small amounts of it when you consume meats because it exists within the system of an animal, but in tiny amounts. But if you're taking high doses of it, they could say, well, you don't normally consume large amounts of this. So the second limb of the definition becomes an issue, and dosage becomes an issue. the plus point at the moment under European law, which will fall away in, with Brexit, is that there is some very clear case law precedence on, you know, what you can do and what you can't do. And for example, in Germany, they decided that people taking aged garlic was so effective for people that it was definitely medicinal under the second limb of the definition. So the German government said, look, we think it's a medicine. Mm. And it was the European Commission that said, hold on, if you are saying that garlic is a medicine because of its pharmacological effect, I mean, that means lots of other things we take in tablets. What the European Court in 2005 came up with was a ruling that has been very, very good for protecting the sector since, and said, look, if something is normally consumed as part of the diet and you happen to take it in tablet capsule form, that tablet or capsule is simply a delivery system for a food. And so it's still clearly a food or food supplement. Mm. So if you like, that's the 101 for manufacturers. Obviously manufacturers are...
So just to give a sort of classic example for people with cancer, they would be looking to support their immune system. Mushrooms are the way you do that. You can get some very concentrated mushroom supplements now. Would they be considered, because mushrooms are clearly food, would they be considered foods then?
Yes. There are mushrooms that are medicinal only, and there are mushrooms that are normally consumed as food. So if you look at, say, reishi, for example, it's clearly consumed as a food. But there are, you know, a bunch of lion's mane would be an example of a fungus that is not normally consumed as part of a food. And so those medicinal-only mushrooms can sometimes be more problematic. Mm. But it is interesting that many of the immune factors out there in mushrooms, if you look at the diversity of mushrooms that have been consumed as foods, I mean, there is a pretty broad palette available to us. And of course, some of the greatest food use of mushrooms has been outside of the EU. So we also struggle with the issue of the EU novel food regulation that says if you haven't consumed it in significant amounts prior to May 1997, then it should be regarded as a novel food. So we have that little hiccup to deal with as well.
Blimey, it's complex, isn't it? As soon as you start sort of opening up these things that appear to be dividing lines, you realize just how grey it is and how arbitrary it is where exactly the line falls between a food and a medicine. It's just like, you know, down to the how the guy was feeling the day he got up.
Well, you see, this is, if you look at the big picture view on it, it is utterly wrong to create such a broad distinction between things that are food, which are viewed as having a non-medicinal effect, and things that are medicines.
It's based on a bogus idea.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So one of the things we'd like to review in the courts is actually the existing definition of food and the existing definition of medicine. It doesn't work. It doesn't stack up with the current science. And you only have to go to China or India, for example, to, you know, and talk about these kind of issues that we face in Europe with leading professors in this field, and they scratch their head, and they cannot believe the situation we're facing, because in both those countries they accept the fact that food is medicine, and they also accept the fact that a Chinese herbal medicine or an Ayurvedic drug is a medicine as well. It just may be a more concentrated version of the food. And you know, if we want to stay healthy, we will use food as medicine.
Right. That whole concept just doesn't fit the law, does it?
No, and that law has been built from the perception that you rightly say was started with the medicine, with the Cancer Act of 1939, and then it was reinvigorated, if you like, by the passage of the European Community's Medicinal Code in 1965 after thalidomide. And since then, the pharmaceutical industry have been making hay on the back of it. Mm. And of course, now we see an interesting spot where the drug pipelines are gradually looking increasingly empty. Mm. And that's one of the reasons that we see this massive resurgence in interest in vaccines as a way forward, because vaccines as a public health measure and a measure that can be used for prevention give the vaccine manufacturers, that include some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world, the potential to go down this track and then bypass the huge cost of clinical trials, phase one,
because
two, three clinical
not
trials.
The same
because
way
they're not. So they, if you like, they have a light licensing journey that makes it cost. Mm. And then even more peculiar is the fact that we now have a situation since the mid-1980s where the burden for vaccine injury is put back on governments and taken off the pharmaceutical industry. So it's a very confused
situation.
That's
another whole world, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we haven't got time to go there today, I'm afraid, Rob. It's just about time to finish up. Anyway, it's been really interesting to get down to the nitpicking detail of this. It's funny just to think how much effect this very small paragraph is having on a fantastic number of people, both practitioners and patients, and kind of censoring what's happening day by day by day without most people even realizing it's happening.
Absolutely.
So it's a very interesting subject, and one which more people need to know about, I think.
Absolutely. Robin, it's been a pleasure talking to you as usual.
Thank you.
I hope you find that interview interesting. It's always great to speak to the experts, and I certainly learned a few new things. As usual, links to material relevant to this interview are on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk, click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar, and then choose UK Health Radio. A last call for the next Yes to Life event, which is a laughter workshop in London on the 22nd of April. Look on the Yes to Life website under events to find out more. Next week, I shall be talking to Judith Edwards, founder of a worldwide information sharing network of people with cancer called CanSurviving. Goodbye.